From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. I loved the movie Interstellar, but although it was a great picture, I left the theater with a few unanswered questions. Fortunately, there's an excellent novel based on the screenplay, which I highly recommend you read. My guest this week is science fiction writer Greg Keyes, who's written many original science fiction novels and several that are drawn from films and television, like Star Wars and Babylon 5, and he is the author of Interstellar, the official movie novelization. Greg Keyes, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hi, thanks. Happy to be here.
I did enjoy your novel a lot, and it kind of made me nostalgically think of the days of 2001, A Space Odyssey, which is a great movie, and everybody knows how great it is, but if you don't read the novel, there's very little chance that you're going to know what happened in the movie. But I don't think that's the case with Interstellar. I think you can enjoy Interstellar and figure out what's going on without reading your book. But reading your book really did put it together for me.
Well, that's good. That's sort of what it was supposed to do, I guess.
Yeah. Was it a challenge to write?
Well, it was the first novelization I've done. You know, I've done shared world stuff. I've written, you know, as you said, books for Star Wars and Babylon 5 and so forth. But working directly from a screenplay and trying to make that into a novel, when I hadn't seen the movie, so I had no idea what anything looked like.
Right.
So, yeah, it was kind of a challenge. And it was a new experience as well.
So you got the screenplay, I don't know, what, how long ago?
Well, I didn't get the screenplay. They're actually very reluctant to send the screenplay anywhere. So I actually flew to Burbank and sat in Christopher Nolan's office for 4 days taking notes on the screenplay.
So you didn't even have the screenplay in front of you when you were doing it?
That's correct.
Well, they didn't make it easy for you, did they?
I think it's just security issues, and, you know, they're worried, you know, that it might be leaked, and once it's leaked, it's all over the place. So, but yeah, it was quite an experience. You know, I got the screenplay, I guess, sometime in February or March.
And what do you know if Christopher Nolan read your book, or what he thinks of it?
I don't know if he himself read it. I know that a number of people, you know, on that end of things read it. And I believe, in fact, Kip Thorne read at least parts of it to check what I'd done with the scientific explanations.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not entirely clear to me who read it.
So Kip Thorne, he's the guy who came up with the idea. I mean, he's really the force behind the making of Interstellar.
That's what I understand, yes. Yeah, he was one of the producers, I think.
And what he was looking for was a sci-fi movie that, even though it's not factual, but it stuck to a credible, even though it seems pretty incredible to me, but I mean the idea that this stuff could actually happen or something.
Sure, and I think that, you know, I think the comparison to 2001 is apt in that, you know, 99% of 2001 is based on what was known about, you know, scientifically at the time, and was, you know, an extrapolation of what space flight would be like and also what the future would be like. And then you got that moment at the end where you're kind of like, what, you know, what's going on here? So yeah, and movies like that actually I find to be kind of rare. You know, as much as I like Star Wars and enjoyed writing those books, I don't really think of Star Wars as science fiction. I think of it as fantasy or space opera,
right?
Because there's no particular effort to stay close to what we know about science.
Well, because it's kind of a mixture of modernism and antique futurism. I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's set,
sure.
You know, it's like a swashbuckler story, but it's also set in space.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not true with Interstellar. In fact, Interstellar, and I guess I want to give away some of the plot lines of Interstellar, because I think the people who are going to be interested in this have seen the film, and I think everyone who's read your novel has seen the film. Do you think people have read your novel that haven't seen the film?
I don't know about that. Probably not. I guess it's possible. I mean, there may have been people who were fans of my other work that read it as I wrote it. But I think most people were more like you. They thought that the novel might answer, you know, give them something a little bit extra, something a little bit more that they didn't get in the movie.
So what's interesting, and so here comes spoilers, listeners. So if you don't want to hear about this, then You might download this podcast and save it till after you've seen the movie and read the book. In the last part of Interstellar, Greg Keyes, things do get a little bit more abstract. I mean, up until the point that our main character gets inside the Tesseract. Is that what it's called?
The Tesseract, yeah.
Yeah, until that happens, it all makes a lot of sense. And then suddenly, I don't know, that's over my head a little bit. What is a Tesseract exactly?
Well, in this case, it's a it's a five-dimensional space. In other words, there's this idea that there are more dimensions than what we can see. And that the three-dimensional world, and I'm really simplifying here, I'm not an expert on this, but the three-dimensional world that we see around us, well, if you can imagine a cube made of plastic and you shine light through that and it projects kind of an image onto the wall, you've made a three-dimensional object into a two-dimensional object, or at least represented that way by shining light through it. And you can imagine that our three-dimensional universe is a four- or five-dimensional universe, but we can only see the part that's projected onto the wall. Does that make sense at all?
Yeah.
We can only see the three-dimensional representation of it. We're not privy to those other dimensions. And he's kind of caught in this in this place where they've made it comprehensible to him. The beings, you know, who put the wormhole out there and everything, have made it possible for him to work within these five dimensions and to work across space and across time using gravity, because gravity is the one thing that isn't really confined by, you know, it's not bound by the speed of light the way everything else is. It's not bound by time the way everything else is. So
are we supposed to believe that in the story that is both the movie and the book you've written, that there are other beings that have created this thing, or is this actually a creation of us that we created in at some point later?
Well, if you watch the movie and read the book, then you know that it's really supposed to be us in the future. It's like some descendants of, you know, of us.
Right.
Which is why they put the wormhole there to sort of
lead us in.
Right.
That's what I thought. That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah, that's the implication, and well, at least that's what Cooper thinks. I mean, that's the conclusion he comes to when he's in the Tesseract, and he is really thinking about that. That's the conclusion that he comes to. It creates a bit of a paradox, but you can't really have any sort of story involving communication through time that is not
a paradox.
Right. Yeah.
Right, because if he's like when he tries to stop himself from going,
right?
If that actually happened, then he couldn't be there to tell himself to stop from going,
right? Yeah. which makes time travel stories both frustrating and fun.
Right. When I was a kid, I loved Superman's Return to Krypton. I don't know if you remember that issue, and Superman goes back to Krypton by flying at the speed of light or whatever, and then he tries to save Krypton, which of course if he does save Krypton, then he won't be rocketed to Earth as a baby, then he won't fly back to Krypton and save it, in which case Krypton will explode and then he will be rocketed to Earth as a baby, and so on.
Right.
this is my time travel. Well, time travel is really fun. Have you done other time travel things in your own work?
Not anything published. My son, I've got a son who's 9 years old, and a couple of years ago he wanted to do a time travel story, so he and I sat down and wrote a little time travel story together, and I was trying to think of ways to get around the paradox, actually, because it bothers me. But I don't have anything that's published that has a time travel story in it.
We're talking with science fiction writer Greg Keyes, and he has just written a novelization of the movie Interstellar. So you finally saw the movie. After you'd written the book, you saw the movie.
I did. Well, I wrote the book, and, you know, I was working from the screenplay, and so there are descriptions of what's happening in the screenplay, and I was shown also still images of, for instance, the ships and some of the planetscapes and so forth. But a lot changed between the script and the movie, especially when it comes to the effects. You know, for instance, there's one point in the script where it says everything goes white, and in fact, in the movie, everything goes black. And so at some point in the editing process, as the people on the creative end were reading the manuscript, they just decided I needed to see the movie. So once again, I'm in Savannah, Georgia, on the East Coast, and so once again I got on an airplane and flew to L.A., watched the movie, and this was probably back in August, I think, or maybe even July. So I got to see it early because I was then able to correct a few things about the dialogue that had changed, but mostly I was able to correct a lot of the imagery that I kind of was getting from the screenplay.
So what did you think of the film?
Well, I enjoyed it. I liked it a lot. And I felt that sort of 2001 connection even more actually seeing it. But it's kind of odd watching a film that you have been writing the book for, because I knew what everything looked like in my head already, and I had a very firm idea of what everything looked like in my head. So when I saw the movie, when it jived, and it often did, then I felt comfortable. But when it didn't, I was like, that's not right. That doesn't feel right to me, because I for so long had this own little movie of mine playing.
And no doubt you thought your version was better than the one that they filmed.
No, not at all. It was just different. And I'm sure that people, I've never had a movie actually made out of a book that I wrote.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that, that feeling's even stronger if that happens.
Well, you've written quite a few novels, but how did you get this gig?
How did I get this gig? Basically I've written quite a few novels, and so editors know that I can, write a book, and I've written some fairly quickly, and media tie-ins and especially novelizations need to be written fairly quickly because I guess of securities concerns. You don't want a script to be out in somebody else's hands, or even the notes from a script in somebody else's hands for years before the movie comes out. And I had worked with an editor named Steve Saffel on some of my earlier books, notably the Babylon 5 books and my Kingdoms of Thorn and Bone novels. And he basically had the contract to do this novelization, and he thought of me, he thought I would enjoy doing it. He called me and asked me if I would do it and if I could do it, and I agreed.
Well, that's cool. So somebody thought of you. That's the best way to get a job, right?
That exactly, yes.
Cool. So how have you gotten from reaction from fans like me who love the book?
Well, not directly. I mean, I don't tend to give out my phone number. I've seen reviews of it, and, it's interesting. Basically, if people like the movie, they like the book. If they didn't like the movie, they don't like the book. It's a pretty much a one-to-one correlation. So I've seen, both good and bad reactions to it.
Oh, I think it's a noble effort. And I happen to be a fan of the novelization. I don't think people kind of look down on it. In fact, even the word novelization, people think is a ridiculous word. But I like novelizations, and I think yours is really one of the best.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your work that you do. You've done, as we've been talking about Babylon 5 and Star Wars, but also your original stuff. What is your original things like? Are they more fantasy or science fiction?
They're mostly fantasy. I've got a science fiction. I'll do this in order. They're mostly fantasy novels. My first published novel was a book called The Waterborn. And I had previously written a book called The Ash-Faced Moon, which was a fantasy, but it was set in the American Southeast in about 1250. And it's all Native Americans. There's no wandering Welshmen or anything like that. At the time, that's what I was. I was an anthropology student. I was doing archaeology and anthropology of the South, the old, old South. And essentially, I hooked some editors with that book, but essentially marketing said, well, there's no way we can sell this book. It's just too alien, I guess, was the word that they would use. That was disappointing because I put a lot of effort into it, but I've always felt like, you write a book, you try to sell it, but you immediately start on something else because it can either take a long time to sell or it might never sell at all. So I thought, well, if this is true, then I need to take some of the same ideas, but put a guy on a horse with a sword and have a princess in it. And so I wrote a book called The Waterborn, in which I drew really heavily on Native American and sort of Central Asian mythologies.
Mm-hmm.
And it sold more or less immediately, and there was a guy on a sword and there was a princess. But so I sold that in its sequel, and they were pretty successful. They were certainly successful enough to get me my next job, which was writing a series called The Age of Unreason. The Age of Unreason is somewhere between science fiction and fantasy. There was a moment in, I think, 1686 when Isaac Newton was doing alchemy. Everybody thinks of Isaac Newton as the scientist because we remember him for optics and for calculus, but he also wrote books about the prophecies of Daniel, and he did alchemy, not chemistry, but alchemy. And he was in 1686 doing something or other and said in his journal, he said, "Eureka, I found it." And I got really curious as to what he had found. And so I found a doctoral dissertation this woman had written about what he thought he had found. And that sort of inspired me to write these books in which basically Isaac Newton discovers a principle that doesn't exist in our universe but exists in a slightly different universe that he's in, which allows the invention of all kinds of things, like these things called aether schreibers, which are sort of like wireless fax machines and some fairly nasty weapons and so forth. And so it's set in the 18th century, and the characters are, well, the main character is a young Ben Franklin, and then there's a French woman, Lotlien, who is at the court of Louis XIV and would like to be a mathematician, but that's not what young ladies do. And eventually it's got Voltaire and Peter the Great and any number of, there are just an enormous number of interesting and people living at that period in the early 18th century. And it was the period where, in our world, science was starting to tease itself out from all the other ways of, the other philosophies of knowing, right? And in this universe, it teases out in a slightly different manner.
So you had fun with history and these characters.
I had an enormous amount of fun writing those books, yeah. It was also, fortunately, when I was writing them, I was at the University of Georgia and then at UW in Seattle. So I was able to have access to research library, like really good libraries, because this is, long before there's anything valuable on the internet.
Yeah.
And so if I needed to know what kind of shoes they were wearing at the court of Louis XIV and, 1715, then, I had to stop and go, find that out.
Now, The Age of Unreason, how many books are there?
There are four books in The Age of Unreason.
And no zombies, right?
No zombies. No. There are bad angels.
Oh.
But no zombies. And maybe a golem.
I see. So now, when you're writing something like that, do you just like let yourself go and? Or are you like, oh, I can't say that because that didn't happen.
Well, it's. When every time I write a book, there's somebody looking over my shoulder, right? I feel them there. Like when I'm writing, say, a Star Wars book, there are these thousands of fans, and if you're looking over my shoulder saying, no, Mara Jade's lightsaber is not that color or whatever. When I was writing those books, I actually felt like I had historians looking over my shoulder, even though I doubt that a lot of historians read those books. But mm-hmm. I felt them there. And, at the time I started that, I was still very much an academic. I was trying to finish up a PhD in anthropology. And so I was doing academic writing as well, and so I had this feeling that I should be able to footnote this, right? So I'm changing things in history, but I want the history up until, I want it to be sort of logical changes in history given what's happened. So I just did an enormous amount of reading when I was writing those books, and I went to London to see if I could find a place called the Grecian Coffee House, which is a place where Isaac Newton and Voltaire and Swift and all these guys met occasionally to discuss things. And I went to where I thought it should be, and I found a plaque that said this was the Grecian Coffee House.
Hmm.
But it was now it's a pub, right? So I went inside and I ordered a beer, and I said, "So this place used to be the Grecian Coffee House." And the guy's like, "I'm from Australia. You'll have to ask her." So I asked her, and she says, well, I don't know. I think it's been this place for a while. And I said, there's a plaque right outside on the door that says this used to be the Grecian coffee house. And they're like, ah, that's why all the tourists stop, I guess.
That's really funny.
But I got the idea for those books when I was actually, when I sold my first novel, my wife and I had very little money, and we had some money then, and we were able to travel, so we went to Prague and to Florence, and there's a really strange museum of old scientific instruments in Florence, and then Prague itself is just this kind of evocative place that also was kind of caught between, you know, magic and science in a lot of ways. And so when I came back from that trip, my editor, who at the time was a woman named Veronica Chapman, asked me if I'd gotten any ideas on the trip. And I said, well, I got this idea, and it was just a really short, I didn't realize I was just pitching. I was still thinking about it. I made a really short presentation about, you know, the book where history had changed and blah, blah, blah. And she called me back two days later and asked me if I could make that three books. And at that point in time, I mean, my first couple of novels had been published, and I was feeling very, you know, basically if she had asked me if I would put on some sauce and be barbecued, I probably would have said yes. I really didn't know if I could write those books or not. I had a lot of knowledge of the 18th century American Southeast, but, you know, I had to come up to speed on Europe. But you know, it worked out.
No, that's great.
The books are particularly well liked in France, actually.
Oh yeah, so they've been translated.
Oh, they've been translated into, yeah, dozens of languages.
Well, that must be gratifying.
Yeah, it's actually kind of fun. When I do career day at my kids' school, I always take the books and see if they can guess what language this is.
We're talking with Dr. Greg Keyes. You have your PhD. Right?
I did not finish my PhD. I started writing novels instead.
Never mind then, Mr. Greg Keyes. We're talking with Greg Keyes. He's a science fiction writer, and his latest book is a novelization of the movie Interstellar. So did Interstellar interfere with your writing? Did you have to stop doing something to write Interstellar, or were you just had free time?
No, actually, as it turned out, I had actually just finished doing another media tie-in. I did, they've kind of rebooted the Planet of the Apes franchise.
Oh, right, that's right. You did that.
And I wrote a book set between the two movies to sort of fill in the gap.
Oh, so that's not a novelization then?
That's not a novelization. I had a lot more latitude there, and it was that was also kind of fun.
And had the second movie come out when you wrote that? No.
No. In fact, they did send me a script, actually, so I could see what was going to be in the second movie. But my novel was supposed to be set pretty close to the end of the first movie. I had some friends, two friends, one was an anthropologist who worked with language apes, and another was a person who worked years rehabilitating apes who had been abused in, you know, carnivals and movie making and so forth and labs. And so I immediately just called those two and talked to them for several hours about that kind of thing, because one of the central characters in the book is, I don't know if you've seen the movies, but is an ape that had been very badly abused. I kind of got to do his backstory, so that was
the gorilla character.
No, he's a bonobo actually, but he has kind of a scarred eye.
Oh, uh-huh.
Koba. But anyway.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was kind of depressing, but interesting research.
Yeah. So what are you working on now?
Well, now I'm writing another original novel. I don't have a title for it yet. I'm only about 100 pages into it. So it's still kind of evolving.
Do you think time travel will ever be possible?
Well, it is possible. We're always traveling forward in time.
Oh, yeah.
And we can always find ways to travel, you know, more quickly in time. And you know, and the ideas that are played with an Interstellar, you know, like the faster you go, the slower time moves relative, you know, for you. So if you go at half the speed of light to Alpha Centauri and back, and you come home, everybody that you knew or ever knew was dead, and only a short time has passed for you. So that kind of time travel, yes. I mean, it's all possible in terms of relativity. Traveling back in time, I've never seen a convincing case for it to be possible. I mean, there is one way that we travel back in time every day, and that's when we look up into the night sky and look at, or every night, and see stars, because the stars we're seeing seeing them as they were millions, sometimes billions of years ago, depending on what we're looking at, because it takes light that long to get here. But it's not really traveling in time. It's just kind of looking back in time.
Looking back.
Yeah.
Greg Keyes, I enjoyed your book very much. I'm going to dip into more of your work, and I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thanks for having me. Really enjoyed it.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Greg Keyes. He's the author of Interstellar, the official movie novelization. And coming out in May, he's the author of what looks like a great book called Footprints in the Sky. It's an original science fiction novel about an extrasolar planet being terraformed by the descendants of Pueblo peoples like the Hopi and the Zuni. Greg Keyes. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. This is Gary Shapiro. I'll see you next time.